The good news is that we have tremendous power over our health and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle factors, and also would help with global health, both from a climate change standpoint and from a pandemic risk standpoint.
Welcome back to another episode of the Live Vegan Podcast. My name is Kevin Leahy, and as always, we are joined by the great and wonderful Ben Lawa. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kevin.
What's going
on?
Hey,
so how healthy do you think you eat?
I would say I'd give myself a 7 out of 10, 7.5, maybe 8, between 7 and 8, depending on the week.
Okay. I'm
How about you?
If I got to rate it, 6.38.
Wow. It's very specific. I feel like you've done this before.
I put a lot of thought into this. That didn't just come right off the top of my head.
Okay. So are you going to ask how we can make that better?
I'm worried.
You're worried. Why are you worried?
I'm worried that I'm not healthy enough, that I'm not eating right, that I'm going to feel bad.
Okay. Well, I imagine there are a lot of people who feel exactly the same, whether you're at 9.8 and want to get to 10 or down in the 1 to 2 to 3 range. Everyone wants to eat healthier, especially these days, right? We're all on lockdown. We're all in quarantine during this coronavirus pandemic, and we need to keep our immune systems at tip-top shape just in case we get exposed to this virus. And we have an amazing guest joining us today. He has been referred to as the world's number one expert.
Number one.
On diet and nutrition. And not on diet and nutrition as it relates to veganism. On diet and nutrition, period. He is the number one expert. His name is Dr. Michael Greger. And you guys have heard of him. You must have heard of him, or you've seen him on TV. He's been on Oprah. He's been on the Colbert Report. He's been on Dr. Oz. He has testified before Congress. He is a New York Times best-selling author of the great book, How Not to Die, which is a really cool title if you think about it. It's like, I think I want that book, right? If you're just browsing by and you see that title, it's a really good marketing choice. He is a physician, an author, and an internationally recognized speaker on nutrition, food safety, and public health. He also knows a whole lot about pandemics and viruses and bacteria. So this is really the perfect guest we could have booked at this point in time. His newest book, How Not to Diet, was just released late last year in 2019. And he has an even newer book, which has not yet been released, but it's coming in May of 2020. And it is titled How Not to Die in a Pandemic. So he's got How Not to Die, How Not to Diet, and How Not to Die in a Pandemic. All very cool titles. So we are going to ask a bunch of questions as it relates to health and nutrition, and of course, how it relates to our current state of affairs in the world. Are you ready, Ben?
I was born ready for this.
All right, let's ask Dr. Greger some questions. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Greger. It's an honor to have you with us on the show. Let's just get straight to the most important questions. Ben has about 55 questions, but he wants to ask you the first two most important right now.
I have a long, long list, but there's two questions that I have been waiting, I'm going to even say years, to ask you. So Kevin's allowed me to just get them out of the way right at the beginning. So every vegan knows someone who says, I can't be vegan, or I can't eat a plant-based diet because I have such and such condition. Rarely do they tell you what that condition is, but oh, it's a medical condition. My doctor said that I can't be vegan. So I want to know, what is this mysterious illness that prevents someone from eating plant-based?
That the condition is called, you have an idiot doctor.
So there's nothing. There is no conditioning.
There's no such condition.
So regardless of what your ailments are, you can eat 100%.
That's like saying, yeah, my doctor says I got to keep smoking. Sorry. Yeah, I know smoking's not good for most people, but for me, smoking's awesome.
Okay, good, good. That's settled. Finally, I know that there is no such mysterious illness. Okay, my other important question is, every year there's the best overall diets from U.S. News and World Report. They come out with the rankings. And this year I looked at it and said the vegan diet is the 17th best diet overall, 23rd best diet for healthy eating. And this is out of 35 diets. So yeah. I looked at the list. I'm like, okay, who are these doctors that are ranking this?
Who are these crazy doctors?
Among the names, I found Dr. Michael Greger. So so I need to know, why are all your contemporaries in the medical industry not on board with this?
Look, a vegan diet can be a terrible diet. I mean, all a vegan diet says, I mean, as a medical practitioner, is what you don't eat, right? I mean, so, you know, you go all these college campuses and you have all these vegans doing it for, you know, the health of the planet or health of animals. And they're, you know, living off of French fries and beer or something, right? I mean, it's some of the worst foods on the planet, Coca-Cola, potato chips, are strictly vegan. And so, I mean, as a physician, what I want to know is, well, what actually do you eat? Do you actually eat vegetables? You know, I mean, and so that's why I prefer, you know, the term kind of, you know, whole food plant-based eating, because then, oh, you actually eat plant, you actually eat real food. What a concept. But you can eat a miserably unhealthy diet as vegan. So that's why just vegan alone says very little about the healthfulness of one's diet.
So these rankings take into account everybody that's eating French fries and spaghetti, which is what I did when I first went vegan.
Well, there's nothing wrong with spaghetti. Well, you dissing spaghetti on me now?
Well, that's all you eat.
Right. And with lots of vegetables on top. Yeah, I just had spaghetti the other day. All right. Back off on the spaghetti, spaghetti shaming.
Okay. So do we need to eat whole food plant-based or do we need to eat raw? Does it matter?
What? No, you don't need to eat raw. In fact, the long-term data on raw food is really disturbing. In fact, I got a lot of videos on that. I mean, we can certainly learn from the raw food, and we should be eating these big salads, you know, these big mixing bowl type size salads. But we should eat a combination of raw and cooked food. Some nutrients are harmed by cooking, but even the most heat sensitive nutrients like folate and vitamin C, it's only about a 15% decrement when you cook, and some nutrients are dramatically improved. The absorption is improved. The beta carotene, and you get more beta carotene in your bloodstream eating, you know, cooked carrots compared to raw carrots, like three times as much. More lycopene, this cancer fighting red pigment in tomatoes and processed tomato products like tomato sauce, than you do in raw tomatoes. And so, combination of cooked and raw, most importantly, we should eat our vegetables in whichever way will get us to eat the most of them.
Okay, so take home is eat lots of veggies. And there are
Eat lots of veggies. I like that.
There are no obligate carnivore humans that we know of. Correct.
There are no obligate carnivore. Of course not. That's right. Ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. You'd be surprised by what you find on Facebook. Okay.
Oh my God. Yeah. If you are getting your health advice from Facebook, then nutrition's the least of your worries.
Well, good. I'm glad you mentioned that, because my next question is, you run a website called nutritionfacts.org. Now, we live in a world right now, sad to say, where facts are relevant to the cause. Facts are subjective. And alternative facts have come at every angle. Why is your website the right website? Why are your facts the correct facts? How do we know you're saying the right thing? There's so much misinformation out there. How do we know you are correct, Dr. Greger?
Love that question. Absolutely. And the answer is, they're not my facts. In fact, facts, by definition, aren't possessed by anybody. They're just facts, whether you believe them or not. So that's why. So if you haven't seen, for anyone who's not seen my videos, go to nutritionfacts.org. The videos aren't me just kind of pontificating, giving my opinion. I'm just showing you what exists in the peer-reviewed medical literature. It's just the gold standard as to what is and is not healthy. So here's the paper. Here's the graph. Here's the quote. Here's the data itself. This is not me saying it. This is what the best available balance of evidence says. And try to keep my opinions out of it. It's just like, well, this is what the science says. And if there's anything, any decision in our life that should be made upon the best available balance of evidence, it should be the health of our and well-being of ourselves and our families. If it comes, if the question in your life is, which toaster to buy, then yeah, some random, review of some stranger, some opinion may be useful to you, right? But when it comes to making like life and death decisions, you don't just want to be like, well, some dude at the gym said it, or I read it in some checkout aisle magazine. You want to actually evidence, right? And that you should always ask anyone who's trying to give you advice on life and death topics, where did you get this information? You weren't born with this information. So what was the source of that information? So you can check it out yourself. Make sure it's legit. Make sure it's in context. Make sure there isn't an overwhelming body of evidence that conflicts with whatever, they're trying to spout. Is there some corrupting influence of commercialism? Are they making money off of what they're saying? Is there some ideologic conflict of interest? It seems like a lot of work, but we're talking life and death. And so,
according to the consensus, right?
The best available balance of evidence, that's what we got. Yeah, there is a scientific consensus around some things in health and nutrition. In fact, going back decades, there's really, in terms of the core elements of healthy eating and living, there has been a consensus. If you go to twohealthinitiative.org, hundreds of the top nutrition scientists in the world have come to agree on a consensus statement as what is healthy eating and living. And it's no surprise, it's eating a diet centered around whole plant foods.
Okay, awesome. So my next question then is more personal for you, because when I was researching for this, I found out that you used to work at Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, New York, with Gene Bauer. And what I read suggested that you became vegan or plant-based at that time, but you had already gone to medical school, I believe, before that. And someone like you, I would think, would have become vegan or plant-based because of the medical literature, because of the scientific journals and what they say. But it maybe, based on this story that I just read, you became vegan because you thought the animals were cute.
Cuteness did not play a role. Sorry to say. So never actually worked for Farm Sanctuary, but did volunteer for them. Did a lot of their mad cow work. My background is actually is public health, infectious disease. I mean, so that's how people know me for my lifestyle medicine work. But, first half of my professional life, which is what got me defending Oprah and testifying before Congress and being on the Colbert Report and all that stuff, that was all my infectious disease stuff. Only switched to chronic disease once people, wouldn't listen to me shouting on the rooftops about the next pandemic. I was like, fine, we'll go to the leading killer currently, heart disease and other chronic lifestyle diseases, until people will actually open their ears to the pandemic threat. And so now I get to actually do both. It's an exciting time to be able to share my expertise in both areas. But
right, so you're an expert on pandemics and infectious diseases.
People think, How Not to Die is my first book. Well, actually, the book I wrote before How Not to Die was on pandemic preparedness and prevention. I had like a pandemic prep, a family checklist. It was like the Daily Dozen, but for pandemic, make sure you have your toilet paper. Make sure you have, I went through all that stuff, but,
And it was about
people were just... people were just not shoring up the levees until after the disaster strikes.
Now we need to talk about infectious diseases. So wait, so you said that we need to stock up on toilet paper. So you're the one responsible for all the stores running out of toilet paper?
Alcohol-based hand sanitizer and masks and disposable gloves, all that stuff.
All right, course, now we've got a scapegoat.
That's right. It's all me.
All right. So, yeah, you've obviously on record said that that these pandemics, like we're experiencing now, and the ones in the past, and the ones in the future, are connected to how we treat animals and how we keep animals, and often animal agriculture. So. Is that every infectious disease? Do they all come from non-human animals and our connection to them? Are there viruses that come from plants?
All viruses, human viral diseases are thought to originate from animals, and about 3/4 of all infectious diseases across the board are so-called zoonotic diseases, animal to human diseases. In fact, yeah, many of our many of the plagues that infected mankind or humankind going back thousands of years all originated from our domestication of animals. So we had no smallpox until we domesticated camels. We had no whooping cough till we domesticated pigs, no typhoid fever till we domesticated chickens, no flu, no influenza at all until we domesticated ducks, no leprosy until water buffalo were domesticated. Cold virus came from cattle or horses. I mean, how often did wild horses have the opportunity to sneeze into humanity's face before they were broken and bridled? Before then, the common cold was presumably only common to them.
Wow. So are there any viruses that we know that are not from animals? Or
no,
is that pretty much?
No viruses. No viruses.
You just covered everything I know.
But there are there are some bacteria. There are soil organisms. Really? Some fungi and bacteria like Listeria actually from the soil, so we can get infected without actually an animal intermediate. But most emerging, re-emerging diseases come from animals. Why are we seeing this unprecedented emergence in new diseases? Because we're changing the way animals live on a global scale, right? The AIDS virus came from the bushmeat trade in Africa, killing chimpanzees. SARS or COVID-19 traced back to the exotic wild animal trade, these live animal wet markets in Asia. You know, mad cow, because we turned, herbivores like cows and sheep into carnivores and cannibals by feeding them slaughterhouse waste, blood, and manure. Our last pandemic, swine flu, in 2009 arose not from some backwater wet market in Asia, but largely made in the USA on industrial pig operations in the United States, you know. Thankfully, swine flu was only a Category 1 pandemic, resulting in about 500,000 deaths. But look, the last time a bird flu virus jumped species and spread easily human to human, it triggered the worst plague in history, the 1918 flu pandemic, killed 50 million people. And, from the point of view of this virus, the same trench warfare conditions exist today. In every industrial chicken shed, in every industrial egg operation, confined, crowded, stressed, but by the billions, not just millions. And now we have bird flu viruses like H5N1, H7N9, poised to kill millions around the globe should they lock in the necessary mutations to easily spread human to human. We have to change the way we raise animals.
It would be really hard to get those kinds of infectious diseases to the general population if we had indeed a perfectly vegan world.
You don't even need a vegan world to prevent pandemics. You could make meat, you could cultivate meat to grow muscle cells in a lab. People could eat all the meat they want, still have no pandemic risk because you're making meat without lungs. You know, you're not going to get fecal bacteria like Salmonella, E. coli if you're making meat without guts. These are intestinal pathogens, fecal pathogens. You don't need the feces if you're just interested in the muscle meat. So people could have their meat and eat it too, as long as these animals aren't breathing. A lot of these plant-based meats, you know, not particularly healthy from a, you know, kind of chronic disease standpoint, but from a pandemic risk standpoint, zero risk. And so, yeah, absolutely. For this, my new book, How to Survive a Pandemic, I do want to support these organizations that are working on accelerating the movement away from animal agriculture and toward these plant-based milks, plant-based meats, plant-based egg products.
I had a question about factory farming and how it compares to wet markets, because right now the focus seems to be on wet markets. And if we look at factory farming, typically they are monocultures, right? One species, one farm. And we know a lot about the chicken. We know a lot about the pig and the cows. But we don't know that much about the pangolin or bats. And so there seems to be much more of a risk with the wet markets, because you have all these animals that we don't have vaccinations for, right? We haven't created vaccinations for the common flu that chickens would get, the equivalent for a pangolin. We give chickens in chicken factory farms vaccinations to keep them from getting sick, right? I know there's still a chance that they would get sick, but at least the chance is much reduced. Do you see the
use of vaccinations may actually be driving the emergence of pandemic strains, because basically when you vaccinate pigs and chickens against the flu, you don't actually prevent infection. You just prevent the drop in weight gain that is so economically damaging to the industry. But they still get infected, are infectious, circulate these viruses. And then because of there's this immunological pressure to acquire new surface characteristics, new hemagglutinins, new H's that allow it to escape that immunological pressure. And in doing so, basically forces the mutation of new strains, some of which may have pandemic potential. And so vaccination, we're not going to be able to vaccinate our way out of the risk of influenza. It may actually be making things worse in poultry and pork production. And look, even with coronaviruses, when we think of coronaviruses, there's been three deadly outbreaks this century so far, two of which were from these live animal markets, but the third, MERS in 2012, that was from basically factory farming camels. I mean, camels used to be foraging outside, but due to overgrazing, when we got some, because there was such an increased use of camels for meat, milk, and sport, so many camels that they overgrazed, desertified the Arabian Peninsula, so they put them inside. So these high-density camel barns led to the emergence of MERS, which killed about 1 in 3 people, this deadly coronavirus outbreak. And look, in 2016, new coronavirus emerged in China, bats to pigs, with the encroachment of industrial pork production into bat habitat, SADS, which... we're concerned will lock in mutations to jump the species barrier to humans as well. So the next deadly coronavirus may come from pigs, not pangolins. It's not enough to just close the live animal markets. We need to follow the advice of the American Public Health Association and declare a moratorium on factory farms and really move away from animal agriculture altogether.
Okay, I was worried that you might say we need to start factory farming pangolins or bats, which obviously that would be the wrong move.
No.
We don't want to go in that direction.
Well, if we ate rabbits instead of chickens, we wouldn't worry about the flu. But we happen to pick the two species, pigs and chickens, to raise by the billions every year that are susceptible to a virus that can, infect a third of humanity within a matter of months. In fact, billions of people. We just, we shouldn't be, if you're going to factory farm anything, you factory farm animals that aren't capable of triggering human pandemics that can cost millions of lives.
So maybe it's more species specific. So what I was thinking was, okay, we got to revisit our relationship with non-human animals. And I was wondering, is that just factory farming, or is that anywhere? I mean, could that be, companion animals like breeding dogs, breeding horses, breeding hamsters, donkeys, whatever, or is it specifically just a few species like you said, pigs?
Oh, yeah, no, there's just a few. Right. You can factory farm all the carrots you want. You're not going to get any diseases. So, but of course, now that's for influenza. So influenza, there's just a small group of species that seems to affect. Unfortunately, coronaviruses are a little more extensive. In fact, there's fish coronaviruses. Because of they so easily jump between species, it's a little more difficult to just kind of choose a different animal. Cultivated meat, plant-based meats. If we really want to lower our pandemic risk, we just, raising animals by the millions of any species under these kind of cramped, filthy football field-sized sheds to lie, beak to beak or snout to snout atop their own waste. It's just a breeding ground for disease. The sheer numbers, the overcrowding, the stress crippling their immune systems, the, ammonia from the decomposing waste burning their lungs, the lack of fresh air, lack of sunlight, put all these factors together, really have this kind of perfect storm environment for the emergence to spread a new disease.
Am I rational to be even more afraid of superbugs? The entire world is basically shut down. This is pretty scary on its own, but from what I know about these possibilities with superbugs, it seems like it could be even worse. Is that right?
Oh, well, and where are these coming from? Where are we getting these antibiotic-resistant bugs from? Same place, animal agriculture. The overuse of antibiotics. Yes, doctors are using too much antibiotics, but most antibiotics sold in the United States are fed to animals literally by the ton. Just laced in their feed and water to basically accelerate growth within such a stressful, crowded, unhygienic conditions. Not even used to treat sick animals, just trying to prevent disease in such an unhygienic environment. And now we have these superbugs for which we are losing our miracle drug antibiotics. Do they present a greater risk? No, pandemics are spread. They should be respiratory pathogens. They should have this kind of exponential person-to-person spread. It's typically viral diseases. These antibiotic resistant bugs are tend to be bacteria, but certainly we could enter a post antibiotic age where a simple scrape on the knee could be a death sentence. We couldn't be able to do operations safely. We need to stop this injudicious use of antibiotics in animal agriculture, but it's more of a food safety issue than a pandemic risk issue.
So with all this knowledge out there, all this evidence out there, why isn't there more of an uproar? Why aren't we saying let's shut down factory farms? Why aren't the leading
committees?
Because
my book isn't out yet. May 26th. Let's start the conversation. The good news is that we have tremendous power over our health and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle factors, and also would help with global health, both from a climate change standpoint and from a pandemic risk standpoint.
All right, we're back. Ben, what'd you think? We just interviewed the great and powerful Dr. Michael Greger. What'd you think about that interview?
I think I need to start eating whole food, plant-based.
You're not already?
I'm not a whole food. I buy convenience food and frozen veggie burgers and french fries and stuff.
Okay, so
are you? Do you eat vegan? Strictly whole food, plant-based?
Not strictly. No.
Oh, okay.
I don't know anyone who is strictly. I'm sure they're out there. I just have never met them.
Oh, yeah. I know there are. We even had Dan and Sean Moskaluk that were on our show. They eat whole food plant-based. Indian Rock Vegans.
So does that mean never a veggie burger? Or it depends on how you make the veggie burger. Like if you put.
I think if you make your own and things like that, right? And I mean, even I know people that they eat whole food plant-based, but then you go out for dinner, right? You might make an exception kind of thing. Right. I think that's what I want to get to. It's like when I eat at home, just not eat processed food, just eat better. Eat the Daily Dozen.
Well, yeah. So the Daily Dozen, I was actually going to ask Dr. Greger about it and sort of get into the details a little bit, but we ran out of time. And so for those who don't know and who are not familiar with the Daily Dozen, Dr. Greger created this checklist so that anyone who's interested in making sure they get all the vitamins and nutrition that you need in a daily intake, all you have to do is go through this Daily Dozen checklist. And it's actually quite simple. It sounds like a lot, like when you first think about it, like 12 things every single day. I got to make sure I eat 12 things every day. That's a chore, right? But it's not that hard because essentially what he did was break it down into veggies and fruit with a little bit of emphasis on, for fruit, he emphasized berries. Make sure you get at least one serving of berries out of your fruit servings, 4 servings of fruit in total. And so he broke that up into 2. And then for veggies, he broke that up into 3. He wants to make sure you get at least 2 servings of leafy greens, at least 1 serving of cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, and then 2 other servings of vegetables. So that's a total of 5 servings of vegetables. And then 3 servings of whole grains. So if you have whole grain bread or whole grain pasta or whole grain rice, at least 3 servings a day. 1 serving of nuts. 3 servings of beans, which I thought was a little bit high. I'm not eating enough beans according to this
list. Yeah, but how much is a serving? I mean, that's the thing. Like,
it's listed. I forget. But
I eat a bowl of chili. That's probably got 4 or 5 servings of beans in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would definitely check that box for sure. Yeah, and when we say beans, it's legumes. It could be a whole bunch of different, like chickpeas, lentils. I think hummus would probably count because it's made with chickpeas.
I don't see why not. So that's the thing. When you say servings, you think you don't, it doesn't necessarily mean like a whole bunch. A serving depends what the serving is. It could be small handful.
They are pretty small if you look at the numbers for sure. And then the other boxes, I can't remember how many I said so far, but there's water. You got to make sure you drink enough water or tea, 5 servings of that every day. Exercise, so that counts as one of the Daily Dozen. You know, he says 90 minutes a day of moderate exercise. And then turmeric or some kind of herbs and spices, 1 serving of that just for antioxidant benefits. And then flaxseed. So flaxseed was actually the one that was really not known for many decades. So a lot of vegans had many problems with lots of different levels in their blood. I can't remember what he called homocysteine, I think, levels. And he said it was because we were missing our omegas, which is usually where people get that from. They would get that from fish. But flaxseed has more omega than fish, you know, per pound, per serving. And so if you just get ground flaxseed into your smoothie, you know, 1 serving, 1 little teaspoon or whatever it is, every single day, then you will hit all those boxes with regards to omegas. And then in addition to that Daily Dozen, that concludes the Daily Dozen, but he also says we should most likely take vitamin D supplements because we don't get enough sun, you know, and that's everybody, not just vegans. And then B12 supplement. And again, that's pretty much everybody because B12, even in the animal products.
It's supplemented into that. Into
exactly.
Animal products, yeah.
It's just not a good, safe way to ensure you're getting enough B12.
I just want to comment too. You said 90 minutes of exercise, and you said moderate exercise. I want to point out to the people listening that don't know this. When we started, before our recording, we were all on video. Dr. Greger did that entire video from a treadmill.
Yeah.
So he was just walking. He was just walking on a treadmill for that entire interview. He said he's on the treadmill all day. So it's not, you know, the exercise doesn't mean you're, you know, long distance running or doing some heavy aerobics, like he's just walking. He said, sitting's not good for you. Just keep moving. So I couldn't believe it. I was stunned when we started the talk to him and I looked like he was walking. I'm like, are you on a treadmill? He said, I'm always on a treadmill.
Yeah. I saw him do some Facebook live videos on the treadmill. It is a good way to keep active while you're also productive. You're talking to people and answering questions and you're exercising. You know,
so I'm sitting right now doing this podcast.
I felt bad.
I feel like I should do some jumping jacks while we're recording.
Yeah, he's trying to make us feel bad about us sitting down.
I want to get a treadmill now and do all my work from a treadmill.
That's good. It's inspiring. Okay, so that's the Daily Dozen, and you can look that up online. He's become famous for the Daily Dozen. It was in his original book, How Not to Die. And I think even prior to that, though, as you said in the interview, he was a specialist in the pandemic world, in infectious diseases. And he does have a book. I'll link all his books in the show notes that came out prior to How Not to Die about the bird flu and how to prepare for a pandemic, which is quite a relevant read right now.
So. Yeah, and he wrote all this, like he did all this before we were facing this. So like he was predicting this 10 years ago and he was right.
That he was. Let's see how bad it's going to get before it gets better. Because that was one of his predictions when he said in one of the interviews I saw, he actually hopes that we get to a certain point where, you know, it's not hoping for suffering, but you're hoping for the least amount of suffering possible so that people act, so that things change, so that governments realize this is a problem and we cannot continue with status quo, right? So in order for that to happen, things have to get bad enough, you know, and we don't
right,
really
know. People are so stuck to the status quo that they won't change. Unless it's possibly life-threatening, which this could be.
Yeah. You always say people are reactive, right? Not proactive.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We are. Everything we do is reactive. Oh, no. Something happened. We should fix it so that doesn't happen again, as opposed to let's make sure this doesn't happen in the first place.
Like, but never happens.
No, we're not. We're not prepared about anything. Our species are just at least our current society isn't proactive about any, and that's just not like not even just health, just you know, health, economics, the planet, like everything. We wait for disaster before we decide to change.
Yeah, that is a sad state of affairs. But there is a silver lining to every tragedy, I guess you could say. Given that we do react and we do prepare for potentially that happening again in the future.
If we learn from it.
If we learn, right. Hopefully we learn.
Do you think people are going to say, oh, we should stop mass breeding non-human animals after this is over? I'm not optimistic.
I'm not that optimistic about that. But I do think that a lot of the other alternatives, like you mentioned, cultivated meat and plant-based meats, I think that they will be given a much greater push. You know, they will have much more ammunition now.
That's
and,
true.
And through the government, hopefully as well, like they will be able to give out grants and help out in whatever way they can to make sure that those industries thrive and are successful and give us a whole bunch of different available options. So then the public hopefully will be more likely to adopt those products.
These are also governments who give billions of dollars to animal agriculture and animal agriculture lobbies who spend millions of dollars lobbying those politicians.
I know, man, it's tough. It's tough. It's like oil and you know, solar panels. It's like, how do you get, man, it's tough. I don't know.
I know.
But we saw it with smoking, you know, the smoking lobbyists had full control of the government at one point in our history. They were absolutely in control. And it's not like that anymore. It's not like that at all.
No, you're right.
And so if that can change, obviously these other problems can change too. But you got to do a little bit at a time and I guess take whatever wins you can when you can.
Yeah, so let's react.
No, let's proact.
No, let's react. Let's react to what just happened and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Gotcha.
Yeah. What's happening?
All right. Well, that was awesome. Did you get to ask all the questions you wanted?
No, absolutely not. We could do this for 3 hours. You kidding me? I've been waiting a long time to talk to him. And then, and that was just on nutrition. I wasn't even considering pandemics at that point. Like there was, no, we could have gone on and on and on about so many more things.
Yeah. I didn't know. And I think you didn't know either that he was an expert in emerging infectious diseases until I started researching for this.
No.
For this interview.
No, I didn't know either.
Yeah.
I just thought he was the plant-based health guy.
Yeah, exactly. The nutrition guy, you know, but it turns out that's his actual background. So
yeah, what's funny is like, well, no one listened to me for that. So I talked about things they might care about, which is their own health.
And so now people are listening to him.
That was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I also had a bunch of questions that I did not get to ask, but that's okay. We asked the questions that we did ask and he had good answers and I'm happy that we had him on the show. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I hope you enjoyed, Dr. Greger's attitude. He's got so much style, right, when he speaks.
Yeah, style's a good word. Yeah, he's not a quiet, reserved.
He really comes at
doctor, right? Like, yeah, he doesn't hold back. It's great. No, it's good because he's not just like beating around the bush and he'll come right out, and because that's what we need. We need brutal honesty.
Right. And sometimes you have a professor, you know, I spent so many years in college. Sometimes you have a professor who gets it right, who says everything perfectly worded and is perfectly logical and is getting it right, but he's just so boring to listen to. He's so monotone and it's like, you know, the same thing over and over. Dr. Greger's not like that at all.
No.
You know? You can hear him in every sentence. He is delivering some truth in everything he says. It's pretty cool. All right. Anything else you want to talk about?
No. You know what? I got a couple things that have been on my mind lately in our movement. But, I'm feeling too positive. I don't feel like ranting. I don't feel like being negative. So maybe we'll just not do. Ben won't rant today about whatever's grinding his gears.
Okay.
let's just be more positive and lighthearted.
Yeah, you don't want to talk about 5G towers, I assume. Or
oh God, do you want to start talking about conspiracy theorists and how dangerous that is to our movement?
Dangerous to civilization because
true, but it makes our movement look like we don't know what the hell we're doing or what we're talking about and completely like not credible.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah, listen, guys.
Well, see, you got me doing it. I wanted to be positive. Less light.
Okay, let's end it on a positive note then.
Your favorite ice cream or something. I don't know.
Thank you guys for listening. And Ben, as always,
live vegan.
Thank you for listening to the Live Vegan podcast.